in the comments. So Tobias, thank you for joining us from Central European time. Tobias earlier was translating East Coast time to Central European time. And then Dave, our guest, who we'll introduce in just a moment, is on West Coast time. So we've got a pretty good spread of time zones here already. Before we jump in, everyone, welcome to Manufacturing Hub. If you guys are new here, welcome for the first time. If you guys have been here before, welcome back. If you guys are new, every month we pick a theme. This month we're talking about practical applications of what is Industry 4.0. We've got Dave McMorrin on, who we'll introduce in just a moment. He's going to talk to us about scale and a bunch of other practical Industry 4.0 applications. And Dave, we'll talk to you in a minute. I was thinking to myself, man, we probably should have defined that a little bit more in the title of Practical Industry 4.0 Applications as we were getting started. But I'm super excited to go ahead and jump into this. Last comment for all of our folks at home. We do our very best to have an active stream. Please feel free to go ahead and drop questions and comments and everything else in the chat. Please feel free to go ahead and chat in and amongst yourself. Many times we've got too many honestly good comments that we have in the chat. So if we don't get to anyone or there are some particularly technical comments, we will do our very best to go get back to you at the end of this show and this stream. But without further ado, everyone, officially welcome to Manufacturing Hub. This is episode 149. I am Dave. This guy up here is Vlad, and we are talking with Dave McMorrin, Director of Sales Engineering at Litmus. Dave, welcome on the show.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us today and taking the time to talk to us, Dave. If I can maybe ask you before we dive into a more technical conversation to give us a little bit more of a background. How did you get started in manufacturing? What was your career trajectory like? And ultimately, what are you doing today at Litmus?
Great question, Vlad. Thank you. Electrical engineering by background and the usual good in math and science. Went the engineering route. Got into my first job as an application engineer for a gear motor manufacturer, and then just hopped around in different sales roles at different OEMs, different distributors, and those kinds of things. So I've touched a lot of the different products, whether it's PLCs, sensors, vision systems, motion control, pneumatics, robotics, all the stuff that you see in a manufacturing space. So I've touched all that at one point in my career, then started getting into the software side. So the SCADA historian type of applications. And I think that's why I ended up here at Litmus is my background was pretty diverse in different industries. I'm based in Chicago, so it's pretty much every industry you'll see in there. So I've touched a lot of those different, whether it's food and beverage or automotive, oil and gas, those and chemical process, all those industries. Now I'm at Litmus and it's really a good fit for me just because I'm familiar with we're talking to different customers that are in all the different industries, and it's nice to have some of that background. I'm not an expert in any one of them, but to at least have touched it and see some of the problems and see some of the differences as well as the commonalities in the different areas. I'm now at Litmus. For you that don't know, Litmus has a Litmus Edge platform. It's an edge compute platform designed to connect to different equipment, so different PLCs, sensors, DCS systems, pretty much anything on the factory floor, and then work with that data, either creating UNS systems, using machine learning as an integration, getting data to the cloud, and the typical IoT types of platforms. So the trajectory is really just starting out in the industry in manufacturing and haven't left. So I've been doing this for over 25 years.
If I can ask you, Dave, a question on the early days, right? So as I understand, you jumped right into sales, but obviously have a very technical background. Someone who's maybe looking at early careers and is maybe seeing only the technical side as the opportunity, how did you figure out that sales maybe was a better or the right fit for you? And also, again, like sales can apply to many different parallels, verticals, if you want to call it that. How did you settle on manufacturing? Were there interesting opportunities, or did you have a good maybe internship that inspired that?
No, it was actually a family member who worked at Rockwell when he was out of college. This is back in the early days, so mid 80s, when Rockwell's just really starting to come out with PLCs. And if you're old enough to remember those days, it was a little bit of the Wild West back then. So there all sorts of PLC manufacturers and those kinds of things. So I was interested in that control system. So when I went to school, it was specifically for electrical engineering. and in control theory. So that's how I got my education there. But I also like dealing with people. I like talking to people. I like understanding their problems. And like any other engineer, I like solving problems. So I felt like that was a great fit for me. My dad was in sales, so it's a natural fit from that standpoint. But I still love the technology part of it. I found that if I ever got further away from the technology, I didn't like the role. So I really wanted to get back into that. Just an engineer at heart, but like solving problems.
And maybe fast forwarding to today at Litmus, I guess the types of conversations you're having, and maybe to transition us also to the main topic, which is, I want to say, industry 4.0, but also related technologies. What are you hearing in the industry that's maybe creating the most buzz, but also the most opportunity for end users? What kind of topics resonate maybe with you in the last couple of years?
Yeah, that's a great question, Vlad. What I notice is it's actually regionally based. So I'm dealing, as director of sales engineering, I'm dealing with Asia, Europe, and the Americas. And there's different, I see trends in different in those areas, and they're different. For instance, in North America, the hot topic right now is UNS. I need a UNS. Let's do that. So they're following that path right now. Where Europe, they've already figured out the connectivity. They've gone more towards an OPC UA type of architecture, but their questions are more around data modeling, digital twins, implementing cloud solutions, and those kinds of things. And then Asia is actually very dominant in machine learning. Not dominant, but I've seen more applications around machine learning, but very point solutions, right? It's, we're going to solve this exact problem. It's going to be in a box that we're going to put on the line, and it's going to do this one thing. So it really depends on what area you're talking about. I find them all exciting, actually.
Personal curiosity, why do you think that is? Is that cultural differences? Is that maybe the stage of manufacturing that they're in? Is that maybe the investments from the government? Like, what makes those differences?
Yeah, I think in Europe, I think they saw the value of data. So that I think they just have been on a faster trajectory than North America, and are just a little bit ahead of what I'm seeing in North America. So I figure that we're following pretty closely with them. I think in Asia, it's just, there's a lot of technical talent and data scientists out there that are trying to solve problems that just they couldn't solve in any other way. So I think you've got a lot of very tech savvy people that are seeing the value of data and seeing the value of machine learning and promoting that. So yeah, I guess it could be cultural, just could be the technology that they're using and used to.
Interesting.
So I was going to say, let me piggyback on one more of those kind of three different areas that you're talking to questions, but before we go dive back to our predominantly North American listeners, with Europe having mostly figured out the connectivity and looking towards data science, and lots of the US-based groups still working to some extent in that connectivity, and Asia going to more of the, I'm going to call it IIoT just to upset Vlad, point solutions. Do you think that we can learn from the different groups, or do you think that we've all kind of gone our own paths, and in 3 years or 5 years, we'll see which was the correct path to have gone down?
I think Europe and North America will merge eventually, right? The paths will come back and meet up again. So it's just a matter, like I said, I think we're on the same path. It's just where on that path are we? And there's some different technology stacks, but if you think about it, it's really just about getting to the data and creating value from that, creating information from that data. I'm not sure where Asia is going to go on that. If I could predict the future, I would be on my own island by now. But I think it's just that they've got a lot of technical talent and are embracing machine learning and AI. So I just think that there's a lot more of that, and they're just trying to solve problems that they didn't have another way of solving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Interesting. Let's go back towards more North America. And you said a couple of the major issues that you see most manufacturing industrial groups trying to solve is that connectivity issue. And then from connectivity, once we've connected our devices, our machines, we can go and explore those data sets. But you also brought up UNS, Unified Namespace, for our listeners. Are you seeing lots of groups talking about UNS because it solves some of those connectivity issues? Are you seeing lots of groups talk about UNS because it solves other issues? Why do you think we continue to hear this topic being brought up in industry?
I think it's just been in North America, we just continue to build silos of data, right? Even we haven't learned our lesson, I feel. That if you look at it, OPCDA technology, which has been around since mid-90s, that we could have made a UNS then. If you think about it, it's really a naming convention of your data to get access to it. But like most manufacturers, they didn't create a standard. They didn't think they needed one. It was just new integrator would come in and build something and then not and have their own standard. So you ended up with just a bunch of silos of different data. And I think that then OPC UA came along and we could have solved the problem then again, but again, we didn't. So I think we're finally talking about UNS to solve that problem of I want to have a central location to democratize the data so that everybody can get access to it. So it's really just the way I've seen it evolve is it's replacing that OPCDA server that we had back in the mid 90s and trying to create a new way to get the data. There's some other technical advantages of using a message broker. Mm-hmm. I don't know how technical you want to get into it. There's the scalability, there's the lowering network traffic and those things. Those are all great things. But I think what we're really doing is creating that unified namespace and then still connecting a SCADA system to it, a historian system, an MES system to it, which is great. Those are good things. But I think people are missing the big picture of the big data that we've got to bring that term back into the vernacular. What I think people are missing is they're still getting that same type of data. They're still getting just a tag name value and a timestamp with the data, where you start talking to Europeans, which are looking for data models, they're trying to build an asset model or a line model or a factory model around their data. Because once they push that, they can start implementing, they're basically changing the payload so they can start implementing more machine learning applications or big data and doing bigger queries to try to find some of those problems and be more efficient with it. Because if you think about it, Dave, Vlad, we're still solving the same problems, right? How do I make better parts faster, more efficiently, right? It's the same problems we've always had. It's just different technology that we're using to implement those and find those problems.
If I can follow up on that, have you seen any good approaches for that data model / data context problem, right? Because I've also seen it in manufacturing, and I think that the only approach thus far has been setting down the most senior person that has developed that machine or understands that process extremely well so that they tag those values at the tag level, at the machine level, at the component and system levels. Is there a better solution now that can allow us to process that?
Yeah, people are asking me all the time about standards and what's a standard for this type of machine or this type of asset or for the data model. And there really isn't an answer right now. I think that concept is so new in the manufacturing space, we haven't figured it out yet, right? And I don't know if it'll ever be a standard per se, right? It's the way I approach a problem like these from an application standpoint is I like to start at the end. What do you want to say? What do you want to see? What do you want to do? What are you trying to solve? And then I work backwards. And then out of that comes the data model of how it lands. And before that is where is that data coming from and how you build your data models. Instead of trying to take the topic name and put your location in the topic, which is fine, but actually putting that data in the payload, because when it lands, now I can actually start querying that data and doing that big data analytics on it. I think that's the part that's missing here in North America. And when I say missing, it's just we haven't gotten there yet. Like that light bulb hasn't gone off above our heads yet.
And I think that's an important problem also, at least in my conversations, a lot of times people want to get the data before they figure out what they do with it, right? So it becomes an exercise of let's just collect as much as we can. And I think there's obviously some ways to do that, but it becomes very difficult to tag it correctly for the applications that are yet unknown. So I certainly, I've stumbled in those exercises.
Yeah. I think it's an evolution. So when people ask me about that, we have a data model, or we're going to come up with a data model. And I tell them, it's just basically, don't be upset when you realize it's wrong, because it's going to be, right? Okay. There's no way you're going to get it right the first time, because you're going to learn along that way. So the way I approach it is, you know, come up with a tool, or you just choose a tool that makes it easy to make those changes, right? Don't expect to get it right out of the box. Just find something that when you decide you need to add some other data or add analytics or whatever that data is, that just give them use a tool that makes that easy. So you don't have to go take 6 months and get a programmer to make a change. Okay. A non-programmer can make that change and get the data they want.
I don't know if I would trust paying non-programmer to make a change. But that's a whole other.
That's a different discussion.
Let me jump in and ask a follow-up question, because I generally agree with what you're saying, Dave, of at some point you need to go and build knowing that you're going to have to change. But how are your customers, how are your end users taking that? Because again, having gone through it a number of times, I think all of us know there will be changes. We will not get everything correct on the first go. But if I'm a customer and I haven't gone through this a number of times, and someone comes to me to say, hey, build it as flexible as possible because we won't get it 100% correct, I'm not sure if I would feel like I would either feel exceptionally confident that this person knows what they're talking about, or I would feel the exact opposite and be exceptionally worried because this person can't help me build this data model correctly the first time. So what are you seeing?
What I see is that if in the later example, if they don't have the confidence of it, they're going to try to build it and realize that they did have to make a change to it. Yep. Right. I've done with, especially in Europe, a lot of them have tried to build stuff at home. And this is touching on the scale side of things, but are realizing this IoT space is actually quite difficult to do. Right. It's not as easy as it looks on paper and the way people talk about it. We're getting people that have built their own system are now coming back to us and say, you know what, we can't manage it, we can't expand it. It was a lot harder than we thought it was going to be. Now we're looking for more of an off-the-shelf type of solution. So it's usually one of those where that's fine. If they want to build their own, I'll talk to you in 6 months or 12 months. Let me know. We're here for you. There's no I told you so.
And Vlad, this is why Dave McMorrin is a much better salesperson than you are, because I feel like if someone were to come to Vlad might Michaels and says, hey, I told you, but this is a good first sales lesson for all of our non-salespeople here. You should not mock the customer directly to them when they come back because they were unable to solve the problem by themselves that you have spent years and years building a solution for.
Yeah. Yeah. And basically it's because we've been through this. We've been through all the pain. Let us take the pain for you and make your job easy. Because the other part of it is, why, if you're making widgets or making car parts, why would you spend your time building a platform as opposed to the value add, right? That's really where it's going to help you, is the value add part of it, is solving the problems that you have in your plant, not building and maintaining a platform.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I would say maybe, and I think it's important to discuss those reasons, right? Versus building it versus buying an off-the-shelf solution in a bit more detail. I think that at least what comes back to me is this, the need to control every aspect of, let's call it, the data flow and the data models. Mm-hmm. And the pitfall that I've seen is that in reality, they don't necessarily use them, right? Even when you talk about, I think there's a lot of like vibration sensor type of solutions on the market, and some of them utilize proprietary algorithms. And when I spoke to some of the manufacturers that were considering those solutions, they would want to have access to that raw data. But the reality was that they wouldn't use it either way, right? So they were holding on to that. We want to have access to the raw data, even though they were not going to use it. But I guess, Dave, like, I'm curious to see what your objections are to, because you must have a lot of those conversations with people trying to build their own system and then most likely failing for one reason or another. What are some objections that you hear?
I think one of the parts that I see a lot is, and it's not just building it from scratch necessarily, it might be building it from the standpoint of getting an OPCDA server that then converts to MQTT, or a driver that goes to MQTT, and then they get a broker from someone else, and then they get a model building, and they write some custom code. So they put all these pieces together and can eventually get it to work. But that's when they realize, like, how do I scale this? And how do I repeat this in all my plants and my factories? And who's going to maintain all of these different parts that are implemented in there? So I think part of that is, back to that scale question, is the big mistake is once they get into it, they realize they're on a journey, right? They're learning as they're going. Because this is so new. And once they get to the end, they get it to work. And I just imagine an engineer proud of what they built and solving some problem, a manager coming in and saying, great, that's amazing. Let's scale this at 10 plants or 100 plants. And the engineer is like, how am I going to do that? So I think that's part of it, is just, we've built a product and there's other products as well, but just, I think that build versus buy is, it's like I said, we've gone through the pain. We've been doing this for, you know, almost 10 years. We've seen a lot of different applications. We've seen a lot of successes, we've seen failures, and just using that, leveraging that experience that we have to help the customer along.
Absolutely. Let me ask you a question, Dave. And before I ask you the question, I will preface this with, if you don't have an example to share, I have an example that I can go ahead and share. But we did promise that there would be practical applications. Do you have maybe an example that we could dig a little bit deeper into of one of these conversations that you've had with a group that they've come back a year later, or perhaps you've had and they said, we're going to go try to build this internally before we go through the process of trying to buy this from you guys?
Yeah, I've got, speaking with customers even recently that have built their own and, like I said, realized that it was a lot more difficult than they thought. Again, it's functioning, it works. That's not the issue. The issue is, how am I going to maintain this? How am I going to add new features to it? Because most of the people that do this have another job, another role in their organization. So it's almost a part-time project for them. But I think the valuable part in that is that they're proving out that gathering the data and creating the data models and using that information is helping the company. So absolutely. I think that they're then going and using that to management and saying, hey, we've proven this out. There's an ROI that we can see. We now want to expand it. So now can we have some funds to actually go buy something off the shelf on it? So I think that it's not actually a bad path to it. The bad part about it is it takes a long time. When somebody builds their own, it's going to take you 2 years to put that all together, especially as a part-time basis. I've even seen dedicated teams that take 18 months plus to put something together because they're starting from scratch a lot of times.
Absolutely. I've certainly seen a bunch of that. And then I've worked with a couple of companies that went down the process of hiring those developers and building out this beautiful custom bespoke solution. And then they get to the point of, hey, this works really well for our one facility. Can we go roll it out over the next 10 to 15 facilities in North America? And almost everyone just sits there and laughs because most of these solutions are not scalable outside of one facility. And I worked on one MES solution that it took 3 to 5 developers. It was their full-time job just to keep the system up and running at the single plant.
Right.
And then you go to look at rolling that out to the next plant. And again, it's almost a comical laugh of there is no chance that we can go ahead and scale. Well, so
I joke about the scale because I would say, Dave, they can scale those solutions, but that scale requires a team to get on a plane and fly to that factory and start over. So it's, you know, people are like, oh, it doesn't scale. Like, technically it does, but it just takes a long time. It's expensive. When we talk about scale in IoT, it's really about, okay, I built the solution and I'm going to then go deploy it and do it remotely. And it's going to take no time to implement. So absolutely. Without that, we've got customers, we're deploying plants, an entire plant in 15 minutes, right? Wow. To that level. Now, there's a lot of planning that goes in ahead of that. But once we have all that information, it's a couple clicks of a button and everything's up and running. But again, that's where our experience, I think, comes in with that, is to help customers with that.
Absolutely. I want to go transition this back into the rest of the scale, from connectivity to scale. But first, I have a quote or a paraphrase from episode 107, which is when Vatsal Shah came on. And Vatsal is the founder and CEO of Litmus. And I'm getting a shake of my head from Dave. So yes, I'm 2 for 2 on job titles. I'm not guessing job titles for the rest of the show. But Vatsal was sharing kind of the founding of Litmus, which Vlad and I both really enjoy. And he was sharing with when he was building Litmus and coming up with the idea, he thought that the kind of introductory freebie for everyone was going to be the edge, was going to be the connectivity, right? Go get all of your connectivity into the edge through Litmus Edge. And then the offering of the cloud-based asset Litmus Edge Manager was going to be the main service. And very quickly, he found, no, the real problem is that connectivity. And that is where Litmus Edge comes from. And I think it's a really interesting solution, having gotten some time to play around with it and having gotten some time to know the team better. But for me, one of kind of the big eye-opening things, and I think Dave and I were talking at one point when we saw this, is, man, the real opportunity is to go from one to many. So when you're having these scaling conversations with different people, Dave, can you tell us, are most people having the eye-opening of, hey, I can go build this once and then go push my data in and then very quickly get on and have 10 facilities? What are those conversations you're having?
I think people realize that it's not an overnight thing, right? And I can tell you that plant, the customer we work with that can deploy a plant in 15 minutes, the first one took a lot longer, right? That was probably 6 months to get the first one running, and then maybe a month to get the second one. And you're learning along the way, right? We're learning too, right? And every customer is a little bit different, but we got it to the point with those learnings and with the product that we have and the flexibility that we could then get to the point where we can deploy it just extremely quickly. So I think it's just a matter of educating yourself, understanding what your end goals are, your business goals, because it's all driven that way, and then having the right products and the right team. And in my opinion, it's actually team is more important than the product to get those solutions. So it does take some time. And it also depends on the customer too, right? Because some customers will be different business sectors. So every factory is completely different and have different needs versus somebody that's, I'm going to do bottling and I have a bunch of bottling plants that all look the same. Might be different PLCs, might be different equipment, but the use cases are all the same, right? And it's not that it's not a good or a bad, it's just that customers are different.
And if I can add to that thought, Dave, I think from what I've seen, at least in my projects, the conversation of scalability doesn't happen early enough into the project. And what usually happens, especially when it's initiated at the plant level, right? Because those teams don't often see the entirety of the portfolio versus, I want to say, global engineering teams. So they're very focused on, we got to make it work within a very tight budget within our facility. So obviously there's maybe not enough always funds to make the software or hardware scalable enough for other facilities. And then when that question comes to fruition, it becomes very difficult. And as you said, it's almost a tear down and let's start from the beginning type of exercise.
I think you hit the nail on the head with that, Vlad, is plant people are very focused on their own plant and they're focused on their solutions because that's their job. That's how they're going to get paid. And I understand, we understand that's their role and what they're going to do, but you're right. I don't think they're thinking ahead enough to look at the scaling and how do we leverage this solution here and all the other plants that you've got. And I think having the right, like I said, having the right team, and part of that team is somebody from a global level, a VP of manufacturing, of the VP of IT, those types of groups are going to look at this and bring that bench together, right, to come up with a solution that could then be leveraged around the plant, because all of a sudden your budget changes. So each plant has a small budget, but combined, it's a big budget that can then roll out a solution that helps everybody. So if you're talking to more of that senior level management and you can give them we can save 4% through all our plants, that's a huge number. So the budget's not it's always a concern, but it's a lot less of a concern, right? It's not I'm downloading a bunch of freeware and trying to put together a solution, because we've all seen that, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of good products out there, but like I said, there's security concerns you have about it, there's scalability concerns, all those things that are out there.
Speaking maybe of, and taking a bit of a step back from the data conversation back to industry 4.0, Dave, any other technologies that you see gaining more traction, right? We talked about maybe different geographical locations, but within the US, are you seeing robotics, maybe cybersecurity? What are your thoughts on the different technologies that I want to say are within that umbrella of industry 4.0 gaining traction?
I'm seeing a lot more people looking at the machine learning algorithms. And I know I was talking about in Asia, I do see it in the US as well, just not as much. Bringing in that vision data and building that machine learning in the cloud and then running it at the edge, we're seeing a lot more of that type of thing. So I think that's a kind of a cool technology, because now you're getting cameras that are basically dumb cameras that you're streaming data and letting some other software do that. And the openness of those and the cost of those has really come down. So I think that's an interesting use case there. I really think that Amazon and Google have helped with the, and Microsoft too, but the idea that information is really valuable. So I think like when you're going on a website and looking at some product and then it shows up on every other device that you have in there, as much as I don't like that, I think it has exposed people to the, hey, this data is actually valuable. We should be using it. Kind of things. So there's that. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on with robotics and digital twin type technology that they're leveraging, because one of the big things about digital twins is being able to run simulations in parallel. So you can run a million simulations all at once in parallel, as opposed to doing one at a time, right? So it's a lot more time to value to getting it to a machine learning model, right? And these are some advanced use cases, but that's some of the exciting stuff to me. From a new technology. I think the other things is we're seeing, as IT is getting more involved, right, as we're bridging the gap between IT and OT, that there's some technologies that are coming out of the IT that has been a standard practice for a long time. For instance, message brokers or Kubernetes and those kinds of things that are now coming into the OT space, right, where they never would have been before. So I think there's some old tech being used in new ways on the factory floor. And when I say, if you think about IT, when you say old tech, it's 3 years old, right? Mm-hmm. It's 5 years old. That's old tech. So as opposed to the PLC that it's been running for 30 years. So those are some of the things that I've seen that I'm excited about. Is I think people are really realizing how valuable that data is, whether it's machine learning or vision or just being able to monitor their data and get data to the right people at the right time is just an interesting thing that people are going to start seeing big bumps in efficiencies around their plants, lowering costs, whether it's energy or scrap or whatever. But just getting that data to the right people is going to be a big difference here soon.
And do you see, in terms of, this was one of the questions that I was thinking about and actually wrote down for this episode, in terms of company size, right? So I've got experience mostly with very large manufacturers. Mm-hmm. And I know that the challenges are different for medium and smaller size businesses. You see that for them, maybe that, I want to call it last mile data opportunity when it comes to like machine learning and AI, is the biggest opportunity, or is it just extracting that data, right? Just being able to connect and pull it from sensors, machine devices to get something as basic as like OE metrics. Yes.
I usually dealing with smaller, small, mid-sized companies, they're a lot further behind. Right. They may have no data collection at all. Right. Or if they do, they have some basic data collection, you know, for basically maybe a SCADA system, maybe not even historizing the data at all. So when I'm talking to that type of client, it's really more of a starting to talk about some of those basic use cases, uptime, downtime, machine running, asset health, some of those more traditional use cases that you've seen. The bigger companies typically already have that. They've already gone down that path. And are now realizing that there's more data that they want access to, right? That my historian is collecting data. It's great, but it's not, the data is hard to work with. It's not everything that I want. And so they're trying to extract data from that and leverage cloud or leverage some of the other tools that are out there now. So again, it depends on where we're at. Usually small, mid-size, I'm talking more standard use cases. Mm-hmm. Your companies are more of the, I want to get data to the cloud. I want to leverage big analytics. I want to leverage machine learning and those kinds of things. There's a lot of IT groups that have developed a machine learning algorithm. They just have no way to implement and scale it.
Okay.
I see that quite often. And so that's back to the some exciting stuff that I see. Is that we're seeing more of that machine learning globally, and that it's no longer science fiction, right? It's actually here. And the tools that are out there are not making it, it's not that difficult to build anymore.
What are your thoughts?
I think it's interesting, right? I think that we talk a lot about machine learning, and I think that at some point, we will see a bunch of groups using and leveraging machine learning. Dave, I don't know if you have any examples that are either litmus case studies that you can share, or perhaps more of a white labeled version of where you've seen groups successfully use machine learning, what sort of applications?
Yeah, we've got several customers that are using it. A lot of them right now start with vision-based machine learning. That seems to be a lot of that pattern recognition. And you know, I've got a lot of vision background in myself, so I understand, you know, what they're trying to do. but basically being able to look at size and shapes and colors of vegetables, for example, just to say it's good or bad, and sorting with that technology. And there was an application where we're looking at some automotive parts, looking for leakage, where it used to be where they would have to take the part, put it into a dark room with a UV light and have an operator sit in there and look at it. And it was hot and uncomfortable and all that. And so they put a camera in there with some ML and are now looking and being able to detect those leaks. Those are just a couple examples out there. I think one of the mistakes people make with machine learning is they want to go right to predictive maintenance. Okay. That is a really difficult machine learning problem to solve. And I think the big reason that it's difficult to solve is we've gotten pretty good at making stuff to last a long time. So if you're looking for a motor to fail, it lasts for 10, 15 years. So I don't have a lot of data on what a failure looks like.
Okay.
Right? Now, if I have thousands and thousands of motors and I'm monitoring all of them, that's great. But we can do that. I also feel I'm getting a little off topic here, but I think people confuse prescriptive maintenance with predictive maintenance, right? You were talking about the vibration sensors on there. That's great because that vibration sensor is going to look, take that frequency, convert it into the time series data, convert it into the frequency domain, and look for those changes in the vibration, right? That's prescriptive. Mm-hmm. A lot of people still call that predictive, but it really isn't. Predictive to me would be this motor's got an 85% chance of failure in 3 weeks. And then you can go to the next step is, hey, go automatically create a work order to replace it, which then goes and orders the part for you. And now that just magically happens. And that's where the technology is heading, to be able to do that stuff automatically. And I don't think that's scary for anybody anymore. When I can go buy pretty much anything I could ever think of with a button click on my phone and have it show up in 3 days, people are realizing it's not science fiction anymore, like I said.
Absolutely. No, I think that's very interesting. I appreciate kind of the examples. I guess I want to ask the question, and I feel like I'm stealing it from Vlad. But Dave, at what point is it machine learning on top of vision systems versus we're just installing the vision system like we've always installed the vision system and trained whatever it is, the software that we're typically having? Can you maybe help with that delineation, please?
Sure. The way I look at the smart cameras and the vision systems that have been traditionally done are typically done on very consistent type of parts, right? It's the same part over and over again. Or if it's different parts, we're going to run this part this day. I'm going to switch a button and I'm going to run these parts the next, but it's going to be the same product over and over. Did the hole get drilled? Did the glue get down, put down in the right place? Is the gasket in place? Those kinds of solutions. So it's very repeatable type of stuff. What I see in vision, the machine learning, what really is making a difference there is you're starting to see like safety applications. Is this person wearing a hard hat? Is this person walking not in the right place? Do they have their PPE on? It's the color and size of stuff that's not repeatable. Like I said, vegetables, for example, things that grow, that the machine learning really, something that would be either extremely difficult to do or impossible in traditional vision systems are now, those are a great fit for the machine learning type of applications because of the variance and the applications. And if you really think about it, it's really all about the pattern recognition, right? We came out with the face recognition for your iPhone or getting into places. And there's a lot of effort in the last decade of putting in visual machine learning and pattern recognition. And I think they're leveraging that technology to then be used in industrial spaces, manufacturing spaces, to do these applications that were just impossible before.
No, very interesting. I appreciate that. We appear to have lost Vlad. I was actually typing while we were doing that. So there is a 20% chance that I've accidentally booted Vlad out with a couple of keystrokes.
That's probably higher than that, Dave.
I was on a completely different screen, Dave, but that is okay. I actually want to take this moment to transition the conversation that we're having from Manufacturing Hub to a show that Dave is doing, Do More With Data Live. And I have promised to give Dave the chance to go describe his own show. So Dave, on the hottest of hot seats, tell everyone what Do More With Data Live is, please.
Great. Yeah, thanks, Dave. So Do More With Data Live is it's a bi-weekly show. It's hosted by myself and Mark Decker, who is at Litmus. We're trying to do it every 2 weeks, as how difficult that could be, Dave, with just our schedules. And we try to have a guest on in the industry to talk about just like we're talking about here, like talking about use cases, applications, pitfalls, successes, those kinds of things. And it's really going to be focused around industrial data operations. We felt there was a need really to help educate people on Industry 4.0, and just that's what we live every day. So we're trying to help people understand what the downsides are, what the risks are with this, to understand the technology and the new stuff that's coming out there, and just really taking the data that you've been, maybe you're collecting data, maybe you're not collecting any data, but taking the data and really leveraging it to help improve your business. And we'll discuss, it's going to be more technical related, I think. It's going to be talking about different types of brokers and technologies like UNS, like ML, those kinds of things, and different architectures that we see, because we're dealing with all sorts of different customers in every different industry. So we're trying to get that, help educate the people that are interested in this technology and what they can do and how they can use it and leverage it internally.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate it. Dave and Mark were gracious enough to invite me on as their first guest. And I know episode one is out with me. We will go collect that and throw that in the show notes for everyone listening below. Otherwise, I'm pretty sure you guys can check it out at litmus.io. I would imagine, we can go ahead and get to the podcast at litmus.io and go ahead and follow Litmus Automation or Litmus on LinkedIn and everywhere else that you follow to be able to go ahead and capture some more of Dave. And if you've enjoyed this conversation, you'll absolutely enjoy Do More with Data Live. I would say beyond that, there have been a couple of Do More with Data summits over the course of 2023, which were really interesting. I think you guys should go ahead and check those out. A whole bunch of different conversations. I imagine we'll see some more of that coming out in 2024.
Yeah, we're trying to do a summit. So the live will be, like we said, roughly every 2 weeks. The summit's going to be May and October.
Okay.
We bring in a whole group of people. So it's different vendors are coming on, customers are coming in talking about what they've done. So it's really a great event. We had a lot of interest in the last one that we held. So yeah, definitely check that out as well.
Absolutely. And then as we are waiting for Vlad to jump back on, I want to transition this to something that you had brought up, Dave. Mm-hmm. And I know that we have talked a bit about brokers and communication, and you brought up the MQTT versus OPC UA versus OPC DA. I want to go jump in because at some point we have connected devices, and then we've got to go do something with the data, or we need to be able to go connect them all in one place. What sort of conversations are you having surrounding communication protocols? Is there one communication protocol that you see more people using or maybe moving towards when you're having these conversations of kind of the foundational building blocks of Industry 4.0?
Yeah, southbound communications directly to the equipment and the PLCs, you know, we all know they have their own protocols. We're pulling the data out using whatever protocol that they've got. And that's going to be regionally based, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot more. We all know who the players are in the different areas, right? Pretty much everybody, especially in North America, are looking for UNS. So they're looking to leverage MQTT. One of the things, I actually published an article on LinkedIn talking about how UNS is not a technology, it's a concept, it's an architecture, right? It's not about any particular type of tech. So you can make it, like I said, you can make a UNS out of OPC UA or Kafka or NATS or any of the other brokers that are out there. MQTT obviously has been very popular because it was born out of the industrial world. So it's got a lot of traction with that. We're not trying to fight that. We're going to be playing in that. But I think part of it is just understanding that it's more of a concept, not a technology base. So I do definitely see the MQTT from that UNS, from that putting that broker in that everybody can publish and subscribe to. Whether it's going to last for a long time, to be determined. I don't think it's going away. It just might be then leveraging something like a Kafka broker for more data, because I think one of the things that happens is that we start to scale up the data, we might be looking at other technologies to implement that. I'm seeing also a trend from going to cloud is not necessarily MQTT. For instance, GCP has come out with their PubSub, and Microsoft released their, or Azure released their, missing the name, event something and some of the things. So I think what they've seen is they're seeing the need for lower costs, better ways of getting data up into the cloud. So I'm seeing some new protocols and new technologies there on it. And this is not one's better than the other. It's more of a pick one and kind of like the data modeling. Things are going to change, right? We're not in that OT space and living in our bubble where that same PLC is going to be running for 30 years and never touch it. You're still going to have that, but you need to be agile enough to then change. So as the hyperscalers start to change their technologies, you have a way to keep up with them, right? So picking the tool that allows you that flexibility is going to make your life a lot easier down the road.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. I will make the comment that if you guys want to learn more about the origins of MQTT, you guys can check out episode 67, which we had Arlen Nipper on. And if you guys don't know Arlen, he was one of the co-founders of MQTT while he was at IBM back a whole bunch of years ago. And he talks about his journey to go build that as a machine-to-machine protocol all the way up through the amazing adoption they found as Facebook leveraged MQTT as their messaging service for Facebook Messenger and the value of that. And so it's a really cool story. And I'm now realizing that it's been almost 100 episodes since we've had Arlen on and I need to go make a note to myself to go invite Arlen back on for another conversation.
Yeah. I really, what he did back in the 90s when he developed that was just amazing. The whole concept was amazing on it. And it's really like the concept has not gone away. It's actually being adopted more on it. Like I said, putting MQTT into a sensor or onto a PLC is probably what's going to be happening. You're seeing that in sensors now.
Absolutely.
PLCs can do it today as well. So you're going to start seeing that become a standard southbound protocol, which we normally don't see on it. But I also look at it as at some point, more data, more bandwidth, people are going to start building data models and pushing more data through this pipeline. And are going to possibly need other technologies for it. So there's going to be a mixture of it, right? You're going to go through that layer of that data flow. So I don't see it going anywhere. It's just more of how people are going to implement it.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. I think we will certainly see more of that as we move forward. I have not heard from Vlad. Someone's going to have to go check on Vlad after the show. But Dave, I think you brought up a really good and interesting point. You were talking about hyperscalers. You were talking about how things will change. But you had also talked about how we've had lots of these same devices, be it pumps or motors or PLCs, for 15 or 30 or sometimes more years.
Yeah.
Do you imagine that with the software that we're seeing, with the machine learning and the data science that we're seeing, we are going to see faster cycles of hardware? Are we going to see PLCs being replaced every 10 years as opposed to every 30 years? Or do you think the industrial hardware is going to continue at a similar pace?
Right now, I think it's going to be at a similar pace, just because once you install it and you have your CapEx expenditures and your depreciation all set up, that you're still going to put a line in that's going to run for 10 years or 20 years and keep going. So you're not going to necessarily see that shift. Just my prediction on it, unless things change from how companies are purchasing things, changes in tax codes and those kinds of things change. I don't see people wanting to change that functionality that much. Now, you may see something more like ChatGPT building a PLC, building your program. Hey, have the machine do this, be able to generate your PLC code or generate a SCADA screen or an HMI and do that much quicker. We've actually experimented a little bit with that. So I think that's what you're going to see is you won't see that the hardware changing that quickly. I think it'll be more of the how you get there.
You're going
to get
okay. There. Interesting. I have a funny story about that. And I almost am sad Vlad is still not here because it's a story from Vlad and I. So if you guys are our new listeners, in November, Vlad and I were in Germany for SPS Nuremberg. We were doing a bunch of work, having a bunch of conversations with the Siemens group. Siemens had a virtual PLC that they launched officially last year, and we had been able to play around with it in beta. And so pricing came out, and pricing is basically the cost of the PLC divided by 7. And they looked at us and they're like, because we imagine someone's going to keep their PLC for 7 years. And Vlad looks at them and he's at least 30 years, maybe 50 years if I can, but at least 30 years. No one would ever consider having to replace a PLC as hardware over the course of 7 years.
Yeah, I just don't really see that happening. I could be wrong on that, but I'm not seeing that changing very often. I always joke with somebody that as soon as eBay becomes your parts store, it's time to upgrade.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I get the reasons why. It's one machine, it's doing one job, and if I don't do this, I'm stuck. So it gets difficult to just take that offline and replace it and upgrade it.
Absolutely. No, I would agree with that. I think that it's certainly possible that we see a next generation of hardware come out that replaces a bunch of things, but I would imagine or hope that the next generation of hardware that comes out is built to have the industrial life cycle of what we as industrial folks expect, because at the end of the day, we know no one is going to magically start upgrading PLCs or other controllers at the same rate that they upgrade servers and hardware that we see on the factory floor.
Yeah. Like I said, I remember reading something as ChatGPT became popular and AI and ML and people talking about worrying about their jobs and is my job going to be replaced? And a friend of mine posted a meme was basically AI is not going to replace your job. Your job's going to be replaced by somebody using AI. Right. Yeah. And I think that's going to be similar. Like you're going to see the development of that machine happen much quicker because of the tools we've got. Or you can see that upgrade happen because I can take that ladder code and have it converted over to the newer controller and do that much quicker and work out of the box than you would. So I don't think it's going to be, ML is not going to replace a PLC or anything new with that. I think that technology is here to stay for a little while longer. I think it's just going to be people are going to approach it differently. They're going to use Absolutely. The tools out there to implement.
Absolutely, Dave. I would certainly agree with this. And I super appreciate you coming on to have these conversations. We will give Vlad another minute or two to see if he's got a chance to jump back on, because this is normally the point in time where I'm like, Vlad, we have somehow managed to make it to the end of the conversation and have a couple of minutes to go ahead and ask one last question. And so we'd let Vlad ask one question that would drive us 15 minutes over our normally allotted time. But we'll give him a minute or two to see if everything is okay on his end. I guess from your side, Dave, one of my favorite questions is I like to ask predictions. And I know you gave us some, and I know you talked about the differences in different geographical areas, but do you have a prediction as to what we're going to see for Industry 4.0, be it adoption or something else into the future?
Yeah, I think it's definitely going to be adopted. It's going to be one of those where if you're not leveraging the data and ML and those kinds of things, your days are numbered. And it's, I also feel there's going to be a lot more. I'm already seeing it where they're going to be very ML focused. Those will probably be acquired by the bigger players in the industry and leveraging it. Because the value add, we like to partner with machine learning AI companies because Litmus Edge is really the plumbing for them. Mm-hmm. So we're taking away the custom code that they had to develop to get data out, transform it, implement it. That's not value add to them. Value add is them solving a problem with ML. We become the infrastructure to house that and help them along that journey. So we're the necessary evil you have to get to that point.
So I will tell you, and I'll tell our listeners the same thing I feel like I said last year when we were sitting at Hanover together is, and what I told Vatsal on the show is, I really wish I knew that Litmus and the plumbing, if you will, existed 5 years ago, 10 years ago, because it solves so many of the very basic problems that you see lots of integrators run into as to how do we do this. Is there a standardized structure that allows us to go through this process of building, of making the connections, and then we can connect every line so it looks the same, every facility so that it looks like the same, so that I can then quite literally go deploy my solution as I want to go deploy my solution, as opposed to so that it takes me 6 months or 4 years in order to go make everything exactly the same so that I can go from one facility to two facilities.
Right. And I think that the commonality I see in that is that it's the protocol conversion, pick your choice of tool on it. We have all the drivers built in, and then message brokers are really key to all of this, in my opinion, because that is helping with that scale and volume of data and the ability to, and when I say scale, it's not just scaling vertically and putting more applications in it, scale and horizontally as well, and in multiple plants, because now you can start gathering data very easily using wildcards and those kinds of things that just didn't exist before. So we're able to actually implement solutions quite quickly. So I think you're going to see an acceleration of some of the solutions we'll get, which will get us closer to that, starting to implement those machine learning applications and solutions as well. I see some commonalities, but I also see there's everybody's different too, right? The commonalities are protocol conversion, message broker, analytics, all at the edge. The differences are, I got to be in an ISA 95 hierarchy, so how do I architect it this way? I have a remote location with a little bit of data. How do I architect that? So that's where I see the differences. It's, there's a pattern, but everybody's a little bit different.
Right? Absolutely. So
finding an agile, flexible system is also key.
Well, you make it sound so easy. So thank you. you just find a flexible, agile system. And when we go ahead and design these things, let's design knowing that we'll be wrong. So let's design so that we can fix it as easy as we can possibly fix it. All of these wise words of wisdom that we both know and probably most of our listeners know are completely truthful. But it makes it no less difficult if you're at the very beginning of this process. But no, Dave, this has been awesome. A couple of last questions for you. And as we were going through this, I realized that I completely did not prepare you for this. So I 100% apologize. But I know you're as good on your feet as anyone else. So we've got probably 20 or 30% of our listeners that are fairly early in their career, or perhaps finally to the middle part of their career. We'd like to know some career advice. Looking back on your career, perhaps the advice that you give maybe young engineers looking to make a go of it at industry.
Yeah. I'm probably one of the worst people to give career advice based on my background, just trying to find my place. And I feel like I've actually found it now. So it's really, I think it's find something you really enjoy to do. And like I said, mine is really problem solving. So and talking with people. So I just love helping educate people, helping solve their problems, seeing them successful. So I think that's part of it. Just finding out what really is your passion. And follow that along. And I've always loved the technology. I've loved manufacturing. I've loved working with making something. I remember back in the days of writing a VB6 program and pressing a button on the screen and seeing a motor start. It was still exciting back then. It's a little, now I could go control my lights from my phone from the other side of the planet. So it's not as exciting anymore, but back then it was. Yeah, I think it's just finding that and also just learning new things, right? It's going and taking courses on your own just to learn new technologies. I'm constantly doing that. My team is doing that. So we're constantly learning about the new things that are out there. You don't necessarily need to be an expert at it, but just have an understanding of it and what you do.
Absolutely. I would agree. Learning new things, absolutely important. I would say that the worst people to ask for not necessarily career advice, but to go ask for predictions are quite literally the cybersecurity folks. If you want to hear a worse outcome of what they think the next set of years is going to look like, it is perhaps I stopped asking cybersecurity professionals what they thought the outlook was going to be, because it was quite literally that terrible. Dave, this has been awesome. Our last question for you is, who should reach out? We talked about the Do More With Data Live podcast. Mm-hmm. Who should reach out in your position? Are you looking for customers, looking to hire folks? Are you looking to have fun conversations? Who should reach out to you?
Yeah, I'm happy to do all of those. Yeah, we've been growing quite a lot lately in the last year. We've been in a ramp up. If you're interested in a role, definitely reach out to us on our webpage. From a standpoint of customers, anybody starting their, doesn't matter where you are in your journey, I'd be happy to discuss with you, whether it is about our product or just in general, be happy to talk about that and some of the trends we're seeing. I'm happy to do that. You can reach me on LinkedIn and my email's on there. I think it's on this as well, but dave.mcmorrin@litmus.io. Be happy to talk to you as well. And what was the third one, Dave?
I think we hit all of those. Okay. we talked about those. You guys are hiring. I imagine you're looking for new customers. You're looking to have fun conversations, a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I'm happy to start a conversation and talk about it. I'm actually quite passionate about this. It took me a long time to get here, but I really do enjoy the role, enjoy the company and the technologies. It's a really exciting time. Right. I imagine this is similar to like when the PLC first hit the market in the 70s. It's a whole new technology and things just changing so quickly.
Absolutely. So. Dave, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to the next time we get to see each other face to face again, which is always fun and never a short conversation, which none of our longtime listeners would be surprised about. If you guys have made it this far, thank you so much. Make sure to follow Dave and Litmus. Make sure to follow myself and Manufacturing Hub and Vlad, who I'm going to go send a search party out for because I'm surprised I haven't received a message for him as of yet. In fact, I may go back to the recording to see what happened right before he jumped out. Fun Manufacturing Hub meta moment for anyone. Vlad was in Lisbon at some point last year and everything just completely died. And I almost immediately got a message. Oh no, we forgot to plug the power, like the power adapter was most of the way plugged in, but it wasn't. And so the like 25-pound laptop that he carries around completely died within 12 minutes, which is to the surprise of no one. So we'll go check on Vlad. We will be back next Wednesday. Next Wednesday, we're talking about simulation and digital twin. And then the Wednesday after that, we're talking about DevOps, all within the what is Industry 4.0 solution set. So please feel free to go ahead and subscribe. If you guys are listening in podcast form, rate us 5 stars everywhere you can. Subscribe, follow along. We do this almost every Wednesday throughout the course of the year. Until next time, we'll see everyone soon. Right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Dave. Bye-bye. Thanks for having me.